tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Francis Alonso reporting. Somali authorities have found the body of a missing passenger from a plane that made an emergency landing at Mogadishu Airport after a blast ripped a hole through it Tuesday. The Minister of Transport and Civil Aviation told VOA Somali that the body of the person found near the town of Balad is in the hand of the investigators. He said it will take days to determine what caused the explosion on the plane, which is operated by Dalo Airlines, that was carrying 81 people. Meanwhile, passengers praised the pilot and crew for saving their lives. A Somali official who was on the plane told VOA Somali service that the crew immediately evacuated the passengers near the hole, helping them put oxygen masks and assured them there would be a safe landing. President Jacob Zuma of South Africa has expressed willingness to reimburse the state for spending on his private home, the president's office said Wednesday, reflecting an effort to end a scandal that prompted a national outcry and led to heckling and even scuffles at some parliamentary sessions. Zuma wants South Africa's Auditor General and Finance Minister to determine how much he should pay for the more than $20 million in state-financed upgrades at his private compound, according to Zuma's office in a statement. The announcement follows pressure from opposition parties, which have sought to take the case to the Constitutional Court. Funding for a multinational force to combat Boko Haram's deadly Islamist insurgency in West and Central Africa remains well short of its target, according to an African Union official. So far, donors, including Nigeria and France, have pledged about $250 million to fund the regional force. However, they discussed the meeting Tuesday. This is VOA News. Three Palestinians armed with knives, rifles, and explosives attacked Israeli police outside Jerusalem's Old City Wednesday, killing one officer and wounding another before being shot dead. The attack outside the Old City's Damascus Gate was part of a four-month wave of violence, but was among the most severe in Jerusalem. The policewoman who died had been shot in the head, according to medical officials. According to Israeli authorities, the Palestinians were approached by the border police for ID checks. As one was producing identification, his accomplices started firing and stabbing and managed to wound two female police officers, according to a police statement. Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said Wednesday that his country's military will not stop its airstrikes in Syria until terrorist organizations there are defeated. His comments came as the United Nations tries to keep its fragile Syrian peace talks in Geneva moving forward. The High Court in Australia has thrown out a challenge to the country's offshore detention policy. It's a setback for opponents of the controversial program. Phil Mercer reports from Sydney.
Lawyers argued it was illegal for the Australian government to fund and run the offshore camps. Acting for a Bangladeshi woman brought to Australia for medical treatment, they took their case to the High Court in Canberra, where they had hoped to have the offshore detention system declared unlawful. However, after months of deliberation, the judges decided that offshore processing of asylum seekers was valid under the Constitution. The ruling means more than 250 migrants, including dozens of babies and children, are likely to be sent from Australia to Nauru. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Iraq says it has begun building a wall and trench around the capital of Baghdad to prevent militant attacks and reduce the number of checkpoints inside the city. An Interior Ministry spokesman told the Associated Press Wednesday that work began this week on the northern and northwestern approaches to the capital. The wall will be 3 meters high and partially made up of concrete barriers already in use across much of the capital. However, he declined to give specific measurements of the trench. The United States and the European Union have struck a new deal regulating cross-Atlantic data transfers after a European court struck down a previous agreement in October. The European Justice Commissioner announced the move on Tuesday, saying she expects the deal to take effect in about 3 months. She adds that the deal marks the first time the United States has given the European Union binding assurances that public officials' access to personal information will be subject to clear limits, safeguards, as well as oversight. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuheep. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Militants attacked a pipeline last week in Nigeria's oil-producing Niger Delta, sending crude flowing into Dubai creeks. Attacks on oil pipelines in the troubled region are on the rise.
That's Chris Stein reporting from Lagos. Details coming up.
Also in Burundi, prosecutors are appealing for life sentences for all those convicted in last May's coup plot. And UNICEF moves to raise awareness about the Zika virus.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, in Burundi, government officials report at least three explosions in the business center of Bujumbura. At least eight people are reported injured, but few other details are available. Also today, prosecutors are appealing for life sentences for all those convicted in last May's coup plot instead of just some who were found guilty. Last month, four ex-generals were given life sentences, while nine other people received 30-year terms, and eight soldiers were given five-year sentences. Prosecutors also say that seven people who were acquitted should be retried. What's more, prosecutors have released the names of 34 opposition leaders, civil society members, and journalists for their alleged role in the coup attempt. All are now in exile. The man accused of leading the coup plot, ex-General Godfried Nyambre, is now the head of the Foribu rebel group. He's Burundi's former intelligence chief.
Militants attacked a pipeline last week in Nigeria's oil-producing Niger Delta, sending crude flooding into nearby creeks. As Chris Stein reports from Lagos, attacks on oil pipelines in the troubled region are on the rise.
The attack on an Agip pipeline near the community of Brass in the southern Bayelsa state polluted fisheries in the region. Senator Ben Murray Bruce, who represents the area, told VOA the pipeline has since been capped. A spokesman for Agip did not respond to an email message seeking comment. A program manager for the Nigerian environmental group Environmental Rights Action, Mike Karipko, said the pipeline attack was, by his count, the fifth on an oil installation since the beginning of the year. He said the increase was unusual after 2 years of relative calm. The Niger Delta was once the site of an armed militancy by locals who said oil extraction polluted the environment and brought no benefit to their impoverished communities. In 2009, Nigeria's government started a program to pay off the militants with training programs and monthly cash allowances in exchange for peace. And Yakwa Nsirimovu is the executive director of the Institute of Human Rights and Humanitarian Law in the oil production hub Port Harcourt. Nsirimovu attributed the recent increase in pipeline vandalism to the filing of charges against prominent former militant government Akpomupolo, better known as Tom Polo. A judge ordered him arrested last month on a number of corruption-related charges.
Whoever is doing this, they are doing that, you know, to probably think that we'll be able to stop the federal government from getting Tom Polo to account.
Kirikpo says the attacks are greater than one man. Nigeria's government is trying to wind down the Delta Economic Program. Kirikpo says some of the former militants do not want it to end.
It is not apprehension by the ex-agitators who have been benefiting from this particular process to get government to come back and see if they can continue the amnesty process and the payments that they do monthly on a permanent basis.
Tom Polo has yet to be arrested. Chris Stein for VOA News, Lagos.
UN agencies are mobilizing communities in Latin America and the Caribbean to stop the spread of the Zika virus, which has infected tens of thousands of people in about 25 countries. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The Zika virus in itself is not much of a threat. Its symptoms are mild and not life-threatening. But the virus is suspected of causing birth defects in newborn babies. More than 4,000 cases of microcephaly, a condition that causes abnormally small brains in babies, have been found in Brazil. The explosive surge of this disease has prompted the World Health Organization to declare the Zika virus a global public health emergency. No vaccine is available to protect pregnant women against the virus, so WHO is urging communities to do battle against the disease to protect pregnant women from being bitten by the Aedes mosquito, which transmits the virus. WHO Maternal Health Director Anthony Costello says communities must remove all stagnant pools where the mosquitoes flourish. He says mass community engagement and mobilization of women's groups can do a lot to provide women and pregnant mothers with the information they need to protect themselves and their babies.
If we learnt one thing from Ebola, mobilizing communities is an absolutely critical public health measure. And then we need to educate health workers, particularly the midwives and obstetricians and healthcare workers that look after pregnant women, and make sure that everyone gets the information on risks and diagnostics as hopefully the situation changes.
Spokesman Christophe Bouyrak says the UN Children's Fund is running a community mobilization campaign in Brazil with messages on how to avoid mosquito bites and eliminate breeding sites,
including using insect repellent, covering as much of the body as possible with long, light-colored clothing, removing places where mosquitoes can breed, and putting screens on windows and doors.
UNICEF is mainly engaged in Brazil, but the agency is also scaling up its support to other countries in the region as a precautionary measure. UNICEF is launching a $9 million appeal to finance the programs. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehiz Ruhib, 12 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. In Burundi, prosecutors are appealing for life sentences for all those convicted in last May's coup plot. And UN agencies are mobilizing communities in Latin America and the Caribbean to stop the spread of the Zika virus. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest, Washington, D.C., 20237.
Winter continues to complicate Europe's migrant and refugee crisis. Reuters reports about 3,000 people spent the night in freezing temperatures at the Greek-Macedonian border. The crossing has been closed due to economic protest by farmers and taxi drivers on both sides of the border. The migrants and refugees are in and around a camp near the Greek village of Idomeni. The camp is full, and about 80 busloads of new arrivals were stopped on the highway heading for the camp. Reuters says up to 6,000 people are now stranded on the road in the cold. Sea crossings from Turkey to Greece continue every day despite the winter weather. Meanwhile, in Germany, the federal cabinet approved legislation tightening restrictions on migrants and refugees. One bill declares that Morocco, Algeria, and Tunisia are so-called safe countries. That means German immigration officials can more easily reject asylum applications from citizens of those countries. More than 1 million refugees and migrants entered Germany last year.
Zimbabwe's Constitutional Court has struck down a criminal defamation law that has led to hundreds of journalists being arrested in past years. Sebastian Monfu has more from Harare.
Justices from Zimbabwe's Constitutional Court unanimously struck down the criminal defamation law after an official from the Attorney General's office, Veneranda Munyoro, was forced to concede the legislation had no place in a democracy. She refused to speak to journalists after the court ruling.
No, I'm not allowed to talk to the press. Sorry.
But you were speaking in court?
That was court.
What was the difference now?
I'm outside court.
In their application, journalist from the Media Institute of Southern Africa, argued criminal defamation was unconstitutional and violated media freedom guaranteed by Zimbabwe's new constitution. Media Institute of Southern Africa in Zimbabwe head Nhlanhla Ngwenya said it is still early to fully celebrate.
It's a small victory in the sense that we still have quite a number of laws that can still be used to criminalize the profession of journalism. There's still a litany of laws that Zimbabwe still needs to fight. But having said that, we are coming from a period where criminal defamation was now becoming the preferred law that members of the ruling elite were now using against journalists. They were now recklessly and wantonly using the law where they felt stories were quite unpalatable.
Another law journalists want struck from the books is the Official Secrets Act, which criminalizes reporting on cabinet meetings less than 25 years after they are held. Ngaba Machazi, editor of privately owned daily The Newsday, was one of the journalists who had taken President Robert Mugabe's government to court over criminal defamation for a story published in 2011. He says the Wednesday ruling does not give Zimbabwean journalists the right to report lies as civil defamation can be used by an aggrieved party.
You still can't write recklessly. You still have to follow the ethics, truth, and objectivity. But the import of it is you just can't be arrested for writing falsehoods or stuff like that. We also have to remain objective. We can be sued, and that still drags our name in the mud all the same.
Zimbabwe is one of the African countries where media freedom is a rare commodity. Since the early 2000s, several journalists have been arrested and some deported for various offenses under different media laws. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
At last December's Paris Climate Summit, negotiators gave a much higher priority to protecting forests than in past meetings. Trees capture and store a lot of carbon that would otherwise be released into the atmosphere. But new research suggests that unless indigenous peoples' land rights are protected, efforts to reduce deforestation coupled with sustainable development may be in jeopardy. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
Sustainable forest development has been discussed since the 1980s, but little was achieved over the ensuing decades. Then in 2005, forest conservation was linked with climate change mitigation. 10 years later, in Paris, negotiators included in their climate agreement an article that encouraged forest conservation and sustainable land management. However, the Rights and Resources Initiative and TMP Systems have released new reports on insecure indigenous land rights and the risk that poses to climate change mitigation and emerging market investors. Andy White is coordinator of the Rights and Resources Initiative.
The term indigenous people refers to self-identified ethnic groups around the world. So the issue that we're discussing, insecure land rights, affects up to 3 billion people in rural areas.
White says forests are threatened by agricultural and mining projects, among others. He says if forests are to ease the impact of rising temperatures, they should be under the management of local communities who have a vested interest in the land.
One of the most important findings in recent years is that indigenous peoples and other local communities are generally more effective in conserving forests than governments are. So now that the world is committed to reducing emissions, stopping deforestation, the question of who's most effective is central to achieving our goals from Paris.
The research paper cites cases in Africa, Asia, and Latin America of governments refusing or resisting to recognize land tenure for indigenous people. Violence has erupted when development projects are undertaken without the consent or awareness of the indigenous population. The analysis says that's causing major financial risks to private industry engaged in extraction and export of commodities in developing countries. White gives the example of Cameroon awarding development rights to an Indonesian palm oil company.
The government offered the company an area of forests to clear to convert to an oil palm. And the government offered that concession without consulting with local people who lived there. And so the company showed up and began to clear forests. And, of course, there were violent protests. And eventually the company had to pull out. It cost them a lot of money, their investors a lot of money. So this is a common occurrence in many parts of the developing world.
He says money is not at the heart of these conflicts or disagreements. Rather, it's a lack of direct engagement with the local community and denying them a say in the design and operation of the project.
Most communities indeed want development, but they want development on their terms as well.
Ben Bowie is with the consultancy firm TMP Systems. It focuses on climate change, ecosystems, and economic development. Bowie says the firm offers tools to determine potential risks from insecure land and resources rights.
The real key here is to engage directly with the interests of local people. Investors must engage with a very diverse range of concerns, and that means understanding them in detail, who in the community wants this and who in the community wants that. It's a complex intelligence gathering exercise initially, but also a process of social engagement to develop a relationship of trust.
The RRI and TMP reports say some countries with large forest areas, such as Indonesia and India, are poised to recognize land rights on a massive scale. But they say there continues to be strong resistance by government agencies, companies, and conservation organizations. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Cameroonian youths living close to the border with Nigeria are celebrating the efforts of a 34-year-old man who dropped his administrative duties in a well-established company and created an information technology training center. His goal is to empower youth and reduce the chances of them joining the Boko Haram terrorist group. Wakil Idi says he decided to help when he found out unemployment was leading young people to join Boko Haram in his town of Kusari. It's bordered with Chad and is close to Nigeria. Moki Edwin Kenzeka has the story.
Wakil Idi says 5 years ago, he discovered that unemployed and poor youths in his locality were being promised better living conditions by groups of people that came from nearby Nigeria. He says many of them went but never returned, and those who escaped from suspected Boko Haram strongholds told stories of how they were sent to loot, kill and burn schools and churches.
Le phénomène de Boko Haram est le phénomène principal qui stimule.
He says that was when he understood Boko Haram disposed of resources that could easily be used to manipulate unemployed youths and those they rendered poor by destroying their businesses. He says he learned the terrorist group was offering up to about $5,500 for each person kidnapped or killed, and that was tempting to poor, suffering and jobless youths. Since 2013, Boko Haram has kidnapped scores of people from Cameroon, including a French family of seven, a German citizen, 10 Chinese road construction engineers, traditional rulers, and clergy. Cameroon's government refused to pay ransoms for their release, but said it negotiated their freedom. Idi says with turns and twists in Boko Haram's modus operandi, he escaped to Cameroon's economic capital, Douala, to learn information technology with the hope of returning to help his fellow Cameroonians by educating them on the dangers of joining Boko Haram and especially providing jobs for the vulnerable.
Je n'avais que quatre machines, quatre ordinateurs, avec un local qui va au-delà de 75 000.
He says even though he acquired only 4 desktop computers before returning to Kuseri, where he was asked to rent a hall for about $130, he was not discouraged from his plans to help young people in his hometown. Among the hundreds who have been trained at the Computer Institute is 36-year-old Hassa Abasmi. He says for 10 years, since he graduated from university in 2006, he has remained jobless. He says he wrote at least 10 competitive entrance exams to be recruited by the government of Cameroon, but was not hired, so he decided to be trained at the Information Technology Center and can now take care of his wife and 3 children. 30-year-old TJ Jacob also has benefited from EDI's initiative.
Après ma formation, il m'a dit de rester.
He says after receiving training, he was asked to remain at the center and teach other youths. He says thanks to the knowledge he gathered, he can provide daily bread for his family. Cameroon's National Institute of Statistics reports the unemployment rate in Cameroon's northern border with Nigeria is over 16%, and the young are the worst hit by this affliction, coupled with poverty. The region also suffers from high levels of illiteracy and ignorance of religious teachings. Edi says faced with these challenges, he allows the youth to work as volunteers in a public secretariat he opens for individuals, businessmen and government structures to treat, process or photocopy documents and have access to internet facilities. He shares proceeds from the business with the young ones while waiting for companies or people who need their services to recruit them. At least 70 of them have jobs in the Chadian capital, N'Djamena, which is less than a kilometer from his center. Edi says he still expects the government of Cameroon and well-wishers to assist him, and he believes the fight against the Nigerian terrorist group Boko Haram can only be won if more opportunities are created for vulnerable youths instead of concentrating only on weapons of war. Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Kuseri.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Stay tuned for Straight Talk Africa with Shaka Sali coming up at 18:30 UTC. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nashwan Kali, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, we'll discuss the African Union Summit Year of Human Rights with a particular focus on women's rights. Join host Shaka Sali and his guests next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC as they discuss human rights. That's next time on VOA Africa.
Hello, Africa. This is James Butte, host of Daybreak Africa, inviting you to join me every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our listener mail segment by sending your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. Start your day with Daybreak Africa every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.